Chapter 19. Hiram Yeager adored his big supercomputer as much as he did his wife and children, perhaps more. He could seldom tear himself away from the images he projected on his giant monitor to go home to his family. Computers were his life from the first time he looked at the screen on a monitor and typed out a command. The love affair never cooled. If anything, it grew more passionate with the passing years, especially after he constructed a monster unit of his own design for NUMA's vast oceans data center. The incredible display of information gathering power at his beck and call never ceased to astound him. He caressed the keyboard with his fingers as though it were a living entity, his excitement blossoming whenever bits and pieces of data began coming together to form a solution. Yeager was hooked into a vast high-speed computing network with the capacity to transfer enormous amounts of digital data between libraries, newspaper morgues, research laboratories, universities, and historic archives anywhere in the world. The data superhighway, as it was called, could transmit billions of bits of information in the blink of a cursor. By tapping into the gigabit network, Yeager began retrieving and assembling enough data to enable him to lay out a search grid with a 60% probability factor of containing the 4-century-old landlocked galleon. He was so deeply involved with the search for the Nuestra Señora de la Concepción that he did not notice nor hear Admiral James Sandecker step into his sanctum sanctorum and sit down in a chair behind him. The founder and first director of NUMA was small in stature, but filled with enough testosterone to fuel the offensive line of the Dallas Cowboys. A trim 58 and a fitness addict, he ran 5 miles every morning from his apartment to the imposing glass building that housed 2 of the 5,000 engineers, scientists, and other employees that formed NUMA, the undersea counterpart of the space agency NASA. His head was covered by straight, flaming red hair, graying at the temples and parted in the middle, while his chin bristled with a magnificent Van Dyke beard. Despite his addiction to health and nutrition, he was never without a huge cigar made from tobacco personally selected and rolled for him by the owner of a plantation in Jamaica. Under his direction, NUMA had taken the field of oceanography and made it as popular as space science. His persuasive pleas to Congress for funding, supported by 20 top universities with schools in the marine sciences and a host of large corporations investing in underwater projects, had enabled NUMA to take great strides in deep-sea geology and mining, marine archaeology, biological studies of sea life, and studies of the effects of oceans on the Earth's climate. One of his greatest contributions, perhaps, was supporting Hiram Yeager's huge computer network, the finest and largest archive of ocean sciences in the world. Sandecker was not universally admired by all of Washington's bureaucracy, but he was respected as a hard-driving, dedicated, and honest man, and his relationship with the men in the Oval Office of the White House was warm and friendly. "Making any progress?" he asked Yeager. "Sorry, Admiral." Yeager spoke without turning around. "I didn't see you come in. I was in the midst of collecting data on the water currents off Ecuador." "Don't stroke me, Hiram," Sandecker said with the look of a ferret on a hunt. "I know what you're up to."
"Sir?"
"You're searching for a stretch of coastline where a tidal wave struck in 1578.
"A tidal wave?"
"Yes, you know, a big wall of water that barreled in from the sea and carried a Spanish galleon over a beach and into a jungle." The admiral puffed out a cloud of noxious smoke and went on. "I wasn't aware that I had authorized a treasure hunt on NUMA's time and budget." Yeager paused and swiveled around in his chair.
"You know?"
"The word is new, right from the beginning." "You know what you are, Admiral?" "A canny old bastard who can read minds," he said with some satisfaction. "Did your Ouija board also tell you the tidal wave and the galleon are little more than folklore?" "If anyone can smell fact from fiction, it's our friend Dirk Pitt," Sandecker said inflexibly. "Now, what have you dug up?" Yeager smiled wanly and answered. "I began by dipping into various geographic information systems to determine a logical site for a ship to remain hidden in a jungle over 4 centuries, somewhere between Lima and Panama City. Thanks to global positioning satellites, we can look at details of Central and South America that were never mapped before. Maps showing tropical rainforests that grow along the coastline were studied first. I quickly dismissed Peru because its coastal regions are deserts with little or no vegetation. That still left over 1,000 kilometers of forested shore along northern Ecuador and almost all of Colombia. Again, I was able to eliminate about 40% of the coastline with geology too steep or unfavorable for a wave with enough mass and momentum to carry a 570-ton ship any distance overland. Then I knocked off another 20% for open grassland areas without thick trees or other foliage that could hide the remains of a ship. That still leaves Pitt with a search area 400 kilometers in length. Nature can drastically alter the environment in 500 years, said Yeager. By starting with antique maps drawn by the early Spaniards and examining records of changes that occurred in the geology and landscape, I was able to decrease the length of the search grid another 150 kilometers. How did you compare the modern terrain with the old? With 3-dimensional overlays, replied Yeager. By either reducing or increasing the scale of the old charts to match the latest satellite maps, and then overlaying one upon the other. Any variations of the coastal jungles since the galleon vanished became readily apparent. I found that much of the heavily forested coastal jungles had been cut down over the centuries for farmland. Not enough, Sandecker said irritably, not nearly enough. You'll have to whittle the grid down to no more than 20 kilometers if you want to give Pitt a fighting chance of finding the wreck.
Bear with me, Admiral, said Yeager patiently.
The next step was to conduct a search through historical archives for recorded tidal waves that struck the Pacific coastline of South America in the 16th century. Fortunately, the occasions were well documented by the Spanish during the conquest. I found 4. 2 in Chile in 1562 and 1575. Peru suffered them in 1570 and again in 1578. The year Drake captured the galleon.
Where did the latter strike? Sandecker asked.
The only account comes from the log of a Spanish supply ship on its way to Callao. It passed over a crazy sea that swept inland toward Bahia de Caracas in Ecuador. Bahia, of course, means bay. Crazy sea is a good description of water turmoil above an earthquake on the seafloor. No doubt a seismic wave generated by a movement of the fault that parallels the west coast of the entire South American continent. The captain also noted that on the return voyage, a village that sat at the mouth of a river running into the bay had vanished.
There is no question of the date.
Right on the money. The tropical rainforest to the east appears to be impenetrable. Okay, we have a ballpark. The next question is, what was the wavelength? A tidal wave, or tsunami, can have a length of 200 kilometers or more, said Yeager. Sandecker considered this. How wide is the Bay of Caracas? Yeager called up a map on his monitor. The entrance is narrow, no more than 4 or 5 kilometers.
And you say the captain of the supply ship logged a missing village by a river?
Yes, sir, that was his description.
How does the contour of the bay today differ from that period?
The outer bay has changed very little, answered Jaeger.
After bringing up a program that depicted the old Spanish charts and the satellite map in different colors as he overlaid them on the screen,
the inner bay has moved about a kilometer toward the sea due to silt buildup from the Chone River.
Sandecker stared at the screen for a long moment, then said slowly, "Can your electronic contraption do a simulation of the tidal wave sweeping the galleon onto shore?"
Jaeger nodded.
"Yes, but there are a number of factors to consider."
"Such as?"
"What was the height of the wave, and how fast was it traveling?"
"It would have to be at least 30 meters high and traveling at better than 150 kilometers an hour to carry a 570-ton ship so far into the jungle that she has never been found."
"Okay, let's see what I can do with digital imagery."
Jaeger typed a series of commands on his keyboard and sat back, staring at the monitor for several seconds, examining the image he produced on the screen. Then he used a special function control to fine-tune the graphics until he could generate a realistic and dramatic simulation of a tidal wave crossing an imaginary shoreline.
"There you have it," he announced, "virtual reality configuration."
"Now generate a ship," ordered Sandecker.
Jaeger was not an expert on the construction of 16th-century galleons, but he produced a respectable image of one rolling slowly on the waves that was equal to a projector displaying moving graphics at 60 frames per second. The galleon appeared so realistic, any unsuspecting soul who walked into the room would have thought they were watching a movie.
"How does it look, Admiral?"
"Hard to believe a machine can create something so lifelike," said Sandecker, visibly impressed.
"You should see the latest computer-generated movies featuring the long-gone old stars with the new. I've watched the video of Arizona Sunset at least a dozen times."
"Who plays the leads?"
"Humphrey Bogart, Lionel Barrymore, Marilyn Monroe, Julia Roberts, and Tom Cruise. It's so real you'd swear they all acted together on the set."
Sandecker laid his hand on Jaeger's shoulder. "Let's see if you can make a reasonably accurate documentary." Jaeger did his magic on the computer, and the two men watched, fascinated. As the monitor displayed a sea so blue and distinct, it was like looking through a window at the real thing. Then, slowly, the water began convulsing into a wave that rolled away from the land, stranding the galleon on the seabed, as dry as if it were a toy boat on the blanket of a boy's bed. Then the computer visualized the wave rushing back toward shore, rising higher and higher, then cresting and engulfing the ship under a rolling mass of froth, sand, and water, hurling it toward land at an incredible speed, until finally the ship stopped and settled as the wave smoothed out and died.
5 kilometers, murmured Jaeger. "She looks to be approximately 5 kilometers from the coast."
"No wonder she was lost and forgotten," said Sandecker. "I suggest you contact Pitt and make arrangements to fax your computer's grid coordinates."
Jaeger gave Sandecker a queer look indeed.
"Are you authorizing the search, Admiral?"
Sandecker feigned a look of surprise as he rose and walked toward the door. Just before exiting, he turned and grinned impishly.
"I can't very well authorize what could turn out to be a wild goose chase now, can I?"
"You think that's what we're looking at, a wild goose chase?"
Sandecker shrugged. "You've done your magic. If the ship truly rests in a jungle and not on the bottom of the sea, then the burden falls on Pitt and Giordino to go in that hell on earth and find her."